Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, welcome everyone. Well, we're about 12 days away from the Winter Olympics, which are, of course, up in Vancouver, just a few miles up north from us here in Seattle. And I mention that because my first guest has written a satirical novel based on a fictitious city on the West Coast, which is ensconced in the 2010 Olympics. And we'll find out more about that in just a moment. Coming up at 12:30, New York Times bestseller Adriana Trigiani blends vivid images of high fashion New York City, traditional Italy, romance, and family values in her novels. She's written 11 books, published in 36 countries, and the book page critic says that no one ever reads just one of Trigiani's tales, that once you pick up one of her books, you pick them all up. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome the multi-talented, multifaceted Christopher Nolan, satirist and first-time novelist of To See the Sky. He's a practicing criminal lawyer with a PhD in criminology and an MBA in philosophy. He's also a visual artist whose surrealistic paintings have been exhibited in Vancouver and Toronto. Christopher Nolan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Vicki.
First of all, I meant to ask, am I saying your name right? Is it Nolan?
It's Nolan.
Nolan. Okay. Yeah. It's spelt Nolan, yeah. All right, Christopher. So I wanted to just start off a little bit about your background. I want to look at what started you off writing, because I read that you were in law school and you're studying forensic law, and you wrote something called If Lips Could Kill, based on the premise that you thought it would be fun, you know, instead of using a traditional fingerprint, what if we use a lip print?
That's absolutely right. Yeah, I was in this forensic science course in law school, and I always had an interest in criminal law, and we learned about these very interesting forensic, you know, identification techniques, and I got the idea of instead of using a fingerprint as the central kind of identifying feature, why not use a lip print? And at first, it was a somewhat kind of frivolous idea, but when I actually looked into it, there actually was a real science of this, and I'd seen that, realized there were cases in Japan where this was used. So I created a crime, like a story, where the central identifying feature would be a lip print on the back of an envelope, where somebody had kind of in a romantic way kissed the envelope and put a lipstick print on the back. And I did actually write my very first crime novel, I guess, called If Lips Could Kill. It didn't go anywhere. I mean, I didn't make any efforts to really get it published, but it was fun writing it.
Well, that led you to be interested. I mean, you're interested in so many things. We'll get to all of this eventually. But let's talk a little bit about your new book, which has just been released. You are coming down to Seattle just later this week.
That's right.
Yeah, we'll give those dates out in just a minute.
Okay.
But I want to talk about the book, To See the Sky, because obviously timing is perfect. Was that intentional? Did you intend to release it at this time?
Yeah, more or less. I actually originally began writing it as more of a kind of an ecologically oriented kind of comment on the building boom that was just starting to get really big in Vancouver in around 2002, 2003. I used to go down to the beach, one of the main beaches, and look across the water, and I'd begun to realize that from when I'd lived in Vancouver, the grade of residential development kind of up along this one mountainside was becoming very, very significant, to the point where the actual mountain face, in a sense, was literally just eroding in favor of all these kind of buildings. And so I got the idea of writing about that and kind of satirizing, socially commenting on what was happening to Vancouver from a development perspective, because I've always thought it's very, very kind of odd, possibly very ironic, that these beautiful, you know, these kind of naturally beautiful cities that people flock to and fly to can somehow suddenly, in a sense, turn themselves inside out by getting rid of all the natural beauty in favor of development. But it was just around that time that Vancouver won the bid to get the Olympic Games, and that was in 2003. And when that happened, that provided even kind of a more even more of a reason, or more of a direct, or more of an intense reason for me to comment on this, because one of the first things that was scheduled to happen once Vancouver got the bid was to absolutely extend and kind of absolutely widen this massive stretch of beautiful Oceanside highway. And so it gave me the idea to, and that highway is called, I'm so used to saying to see the sky now, it's called, I think it is called the See the Sky Highway.
Is it the road that goes up the side of Whistler? Is that the road
you're talking about?
Yeah,
exactly it.
But it was beautiful. I don't know what it's like now.
Yeah, and so now it's just simply wider. But the actual effort in terms of blasting the mountainside apart, right, and all that was very real. And it just seemed to be a perfect kind of way for me to wade into this, I guess you could have it almost like ecological concern I had about what was happening around Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. So I ended up instead of using the words, to see the sky, which is the highway, I put a play on it and referred to see the sky with its own kind of implications for the story, yeah.
Yeah, SEE versus SEA.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Now, your book is described as a dark satire about a series of unexpected events that occur after a fictitious city on the West Coast wins the bid to host the Games. I've also read that you've said yourself it's based on Vancouver's overinflated ego. So tell us a little bit about the book itself, how you would describe the book.
Yeah, okay. It is a dark satire. I mean, because I have wanted to kind of comment somewhat satirically on the boom in Vancouver and its pace of development. But it's also because I consider, and I live in various places in Canada, and also, I mean, I've lived in England, and I find that Vancouver is a very, very wealthy city. I mean, it's also got a very starkly contrasted, impoverished population, but
right,
it has all this wealth, and I've always been, and over the last, certainly shortly before the Olympics came, were scheduled to come here, there was magazine reports coming out, and I can't remember what magazines they were saying that, Vancouver is the number one city in the world to live in, and I just thought this was funny that somehow Vancouver be considered the number one city to live in. I mean, I've traveled all over I've traveled throughout Europe and on backpacks and stuff, and I mean, I guess I think for myself, somebody who loves arts and culture, if I wanted to really go and see great paintings or something like that, I don't know if Vancouver would be the first place that would come to mind, for example, and on all kinds of levels like that. And so I did want to spoof that, and I guess this idea that Vancouver was playing up, I mean, obviously it loved that it was being reported as the number one city in the world. That was what I probably meant by its ego, and the cost of housing, et cetera. There's a kind of gratuitous, there's a real gratuitous display of wealth that you see in Vancouver that I don't see in many other cities. And I was really wanting to satirize that and in a sense, in a very playful way, just kind of get Vancouverites to maybe have a second look at themselves or something like that in that regard,
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you have a protagonist in this, but I wonder,
yes,
and you also have a lawyer in this, a cynical lawyer who,
yes,
who helps a father who's is suspected of kidnapping his two kids, I guess. But,
that's right.
But I wonder, I want to know just if one of those characters is loosely based on you yourself.
It's a fair question. I'd have to say what it was is, I did is, in the character of the lawyer, I decided to kind of put that cynical, that kind of sarcastic attitude, towards Vancouver in the character of the lawyer. And I guess because that's what my motivation was for writing the story. On some level, that, I would be more in the shoes of the lawyer, I guess, if there was in that regard. But I have to say, in terms of the protagonist, who's actually a female, or the, if you want, the heroine or whatever, that's largely also based on some of my own kind of if you want to put it, intellectual views. And at the time, especially in terms of economics views, she's rooted in a very kind of interesting, in my view, a very interesting kind of economic concept that I'd become quite interested in through a Canadian-born but very American-influential economist being John Kenneth Galbraith and his idea about economics. And I devised her on the basis of the idea of, you know, in a society where we arguably overproduce, like everything, just in terms of how much junk we have in our world, you know, and we all need jobs in a sense, but if we didn't need to go to work to pay our rent and to feed ourselves, why would we make junk? This was kind of the idea. This is like this economics idea that I was interested in. So I decided to create a young person who was independently wealthy for various reasons and, in a sense, not make her work. And I wanted to see if we could make her a likable character. Could there be people who, you know, don't see the need to just go and produce things like many of us need to do to pay our rent, but that aren't necessarily that great for the environment or whatnot, and have that person still be a sympathetic, a desirable character. So yeah, there's little facets of me, I guess, in all of these characters on some level.
Right. A little bit of fantasy, too, because I read that she is somebody you'd like to hang out
with. Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But that's the best of being able to write your novels. You can, you know, bring all that fantasy to fruition.
That's absolutely right.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue talking with Christopher Nowlan. His new novel is called To See the Sky. And Christopher's coming here to Seattle. I'll tell you when as soon as we come back from the break. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Do you have legal questions? Need to know where to turn?
Hi, this is Rick Gregrick, your host of Northwest Legal Compass.
Northwest Legal Compass will address your questions on a variety of legal topics, including estate planning, asset protection, real estate and business planning, and more. The legal and accounting staff of Gregrick and Associates are dedicated to providing you with superior legal and tax services. Their integrated counsel is geared to the achievement of your goals.
Visit us on the web at rjglegal.com.
Be sure and tune in every Friday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150. Coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, Dr. Kathleen Sherman says that while we know intellectually we have choice, few of us master the art of choice. If you're carrying any hurt from your past or finding it hard to break out of a rut, Dr. Sherman shares the path to emotional freedom. Join us next Monday at noon Pacific on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And see conversationslive.net for hundreds of past interviews and book review podcasts.
The way you talk about choice, as if it's something we were born with. This choice is for some, but not for less.
More talk, less rock. Come on, that's a good thing. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. We're talking in this segment with Christopher Nowlan. He's a Canadian author. He's written a new book called To See the Sky. This is his first novel, but I know he has another one underway. He's also a criminal lawyer and quite the philosopher and a visual artist. He's a surrealistic painter. So, Christopher, I want to, before we go any further, just let listeners know that you are coming to Washington. This is what I have here. You'll be appearing at Village Books in Bellingham, which is on 11th Street, on Thursday, February 4th at 7 p.m.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, and you'll also be at Third Place Books, which is very well known here in Seattle in Bothell Way. You'll be there on Friday, February 5th at 6:30. So, again, Village Books in Bellingham on Thursday, February 4th at 7, and Third Place Books in Seattle on Friday, February 6th at 6:30. And I'll try and give those out again before the end of the show. But I wanted to talk just a little bit about what makes good satire in your view.
Well, I think it goes without saying that, yeah, there has to be kind of a good comic sense or a good kind of comic sensibility. But I also think that it has to be nicely blended into some kind of realistic, you know, storyline as well. I mean, that's why you're mentioning this character, Joe Newbery. Well, I get a bit of satire there, but what I did is I had these politicians in my novel, and I just, you know, what I do is I kind of hyperbolize them. I don't quite know how you describe what you do, but when they say the things we do, I mean, we all have, I think, our own kind of cynicisms about the credibility of what politicians say and whatnot. So what I would do is I just kind of heighten that, and so that when they're speaking, like in my case, that when they're speaking about kind of the Olympics or whatnot, I put, there's a certain tone to how they say things or to how it's worded that I think just makes us, you know, I hope makes us kind of laugh a bit at what they're saying, and as opposed to taking it seriously. And I don't quite know how you describe how you do that, but yeah, that was what I do. I just kind of hyperbolize or put a certain, you know, comic tone on the things that certain characters say that I want us to be kind of seeing the humor in, or take, you know, seeing as less than, yeah, just seeing as more comical than as taking seriously.
Right, right. Now, it's also a mystery. And I also read you say that there's a magical element there too, because there's a mythological setting. But tell us how you built good mystery into the story. What were some of the factors that you looked at to build good mystery?
Yeah, it's actually, I consider it quite challenging, because it's always subjective as the writer. You don't actually know if mystery that you're creating is actually working the same way on the reader as you imagine. So in my case, I think I followed more or less a traditional approach of, you know, throwing out, you know, like I say, some kids go missing. I can say to the audience that much. I don't want to reveal too much, but
sure,
some children go missing, and that becomes kind of the mystery. And the question is, you know, who, how or why, and in what circumstance. And I just followed kind of, in terms of all the various, you know, mystery novels I've read over time, certain approaches, like throwing out the odd red herring, or et cetera, or in my case, starting to draw us towards certain suspects that seem like very, very plausible suspects, and pulling us into that, but always then, you know, just throwing out one other little, you know, one other little wrench in it that kind of makes the reader doubt that the suspect they think is most likely is really that person. And you just keep doing that, I think, to keep the intrigue until, you know, the final climactic scene or whatever. But I had to kind of wait, in a sense, to see whether the reader's reaction, whether it actually worked. And my sense from the readers is that it has worked, it was a compelling mystery that I created.
Yeah. Now, you are a surrealistic painter, as I said. You've had exhibitions on both coasts of Canada, or both sides of Canada. Do you? How much of your philosophical viewpoint and your artwork comes into also your writing? I'm guessing they all converge at some point.
They really do. I can't explain my fondness for surrealistic painting and kind of surrealistic approaches to issues generally. I don't know where that comes from, but it just means that I'm not particularly, I shouldn't say that. If somebody writes an extremely realistic nonfiction event or something, or even not novel, and I'm very interested, right? But I guess from my approach, I happen to have this kind of preference for a surrealistic approach. And it's very, I would almost describe the layers in my novel as a surrealistic, in the sense that there is elements of Greek mythology in my story, and I did that just to harken back to the idea of the original Olympians from Mount Olympus. So I have literally imported some of those gods into the everyday life of the characters in my novel. The readers have to determine for themselves, you know, who these ones are. But I also brought a child's kind of a very traditional fairy tale element into my story, and that's to kind of play on the idea of, you know, on a philosophical level, of stories really are just mythologies. They're just stories, and I kind of want to reinforce that in my story. But also because I'm a believer in how much value mythology plays in everybody's everyday life, like how much, you know. So I like to incorporate that into all of my artwork. Yes.
Interesting. Now, how much of, or which philosophers, as a philosopher, which philosophers have influenced you the most?
Perhaps the strongest, in a very ironically, is a philosopher named Ludwig Wittgenstein, and I believe he was Austrian. And it's because when I was taking all of my philosophy in my early study of philosophy from kind of the empiricists and the rationalists and Descartes and David Hume and all these European philosophers, it wasn't until I came across Ludwig Wittgenstein, who kind of came along late in the game in a sense, and looked at the way that philosophers spoke and argued and reasoned in academia and in their books, and he likened it all to a game with its own, like a very kind of complex game of language with its own rules, and he even went so far as in a pretty satirical way to kind of suggest that sometimes the way philosophers spoke was crazy, and so he made fun of some of the big arguments that had floated around historically about our powers of perception. You know, if we see things, are they just delusions for that? And if you think that truck coming down the highway is just an illusion, go and stand in front of the truck while it comes down, right? And he was making this point that, you know, philosophers take themselves way too seriously in what they think they know, and that's what was very, very compelling to me. And he just said, look, at knowledge is this kind of specific idea that philosophers use much differently than other people in everyday walks of life. And it actually was so, I took it so seriously that I stopped doing academic philosophy because I realized that maybe one shouldn't focus on the power of words so much as opposed to getting certain things done or the power of imagery, etc. And that's probably why to this day, I paint as opposed to kind of write philosophical essays, because I believe that one can convey kind of philosophical ideas through imagery and through music, I guess, and mm-hmm. through fiction.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. Now, this is very much a novel. It's not a what I would call a preachy novel. It doesn't have a smack in your face message, because I really dislike reading books like that. I think they insult the reader's intelligence. Yeah. But how do you think, or do you hope that at some level your book will make people see the Olympic Games differently? Because I know there's been an awful lot of controversy up in Vancouver. I did not realize that people felt so for or against the Olympics until I started researching all of this.
Yes, it is actually a very heated social issue in Vancouver, and it has been from the get-go in the sense that there was a plebiscite at the beginning before Vancouver got the bid, and the people who wanted the population, or the segment of the population that wanted the Games, was just slightly larger than the segment that didn't want the Games. So it was on that kind of a bare majority in a sense that the Games came. And so that kind of resistance, if you want, or opposition has maintained itself, and our media for a long time, I mean, our media on some level is fairly promotes the Games and has a fairly positive approach to it, but there's a lot of criticism that comes out because there's so many social problems that have come to light that are associated with the Games in terms of the cost of the taxpayers and all kinds of things, and social policy being reformulated. But I have hope that through the force of satire and like you say, not being too preachy, but getting people to be able to have a little bit of a sit back and have a little mm-hmm. bit of a second look at what they're doing, say in my case with the Olympics, that they will have a slightly, you know, better understanding or just a fuller understanding and maybe a better appreciation of why so many other people are critical of them. And in that sense, it's hard to say right now kind of what kind of impact something like my novel has, but it's definitely kind of one of a very many kind of people with all kinds of critical things. I mean, I've learned just this last week that somebody, I think it's an American company, came out with a T-shirt, which is quite bold, which is a really kind of satirical take on the Olympic rings, the image of the Olympic rings, and the kind of the icon that Vancouver is using. And I don't know how long they're going to get to do this, but it's just another sign that there's a lot of people having fun with trying to get a critical word in or a critical voice in about the Olympics.
I see. Politics can't stay out of anything, can they?
That's right.
I did see that Norway was 50-50 split on hosting the 2018 Games.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
After this fellow, I think he's American, Shore. Is that the guy? Yeah. we were talking about in the break.
He's Vancouver, but yeah, he's very influential in this stuff.
Well, he was very influential in Norway because now they're 80-20 against it. So
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I just think that the more people really do think hard and kind of research and really do seriously consider the various, you know, negative, or if you want, you know, kind of the downsides on a real social level. It's not just financial; it's social level of the Olympics. I think it's good. I think it's a very. I mean, I partly wanted to satirize the Olympics in a sort, because I actually think it's quite crazy how, in my view, this massive, colossal circus comes to town for 2 weeks. And I don't mean that, and I'm not belittling the athletes at all. What I mean is it's on the level in terms of an entertainment spectacle as a kind of the big tent coming to town for 2 weeks. And that's fair enough, but you know, the whole city is uprooted for 7 years. I mean, 7 years in the making, it really boggles me that we just still kind of willy-nilly every 2 years another city says, let's us do it now, let's do it again.
Maybe we just need to move away from the commercial aspect of things and go back to the way they used to do it when it was first invented in the 1800s, and just all come together and play sport. And
yeah, exactly. I think that is the ideal, and that's the ideal that we, I mean, even in terms of the values, the Olympics still get spoken. But I think you're right, we've come a long way from there.
Right. Well, we're at the end of our segment, Christopher. I want to let listeners know that you are coming to Village Books in Bellingham on Thursday, February 4th at 7 p.m. and at Third Place Books in Seattle on Friday, February 5th at 6:30 p.m. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks very much, Vicky. I really enjoyed it. It was my pleasure.
Yeah, me too. And please do stay with us when we come back. We'll be joined by Adriana Trigiani. She is a New York Times best-selling author and has one book out right now. Well, she's got 11 books out total, but she's got the second book in a trilogy coming out this month. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Welcome to Book Talk, brought to you weekly by Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate.
Hi, I'm Cynthia Baxter, and today I want to talk about Ron Rash's 2008 novel, Serena, which was suggested by a listener on the Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair website. Set in the Blue Ridge Mountains during the Depression, Serena is unlike anything you've ever read in the historical fiction genre, and I'm so glad that this was requested. Usually I instantly picture a historical fiction novel to include something about kings and queens, and after a while this gets old. So I was very excited to see that the empire in question here was the timber industry, and newlyweds George and Serena Pemberton are at the top of the stump. Right off the bat, we have George arriving back from Boston with his new bride Serena. Waiting for him at the Waynesville Depot is Mr. Harmon and his 16-year-old daughter Rachel. Rachel worked for George Pemberton before he left and is now very pregnant with his child. Harmon is there to extract some revenge on behalf of his daughter's honor, but is instead dispatched himself by the younger Pemberton. Witness to this murder are the two women, each taking in the event rather stoically, which I found poignant, for Rachel and Serena are very unique women, and what follows is an astounding novel of greed, corruption, and brutal ambition. While telling the story of the clash between the Pembertons and, well, everyone else, Ron Rash also brings to light the devastation of clear-cutting and how this act of forest devastation prompted the creation of one of the largest protected areas of the United States, the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Since the National Park Service wanted a park in the eastern United States but no funds really to establish one, it relied upon donations from wealthy citizens to donate money, and land was piecemealed together to form the park. It was tough going because while the government is trying to put this thing together, there's heavy competition from the logging and mining companies to yank whatever they can out of the earth before the opportunities cease. And in the middle of this is the Pemberton Logging Company, run by George and his wife. The Washington Post called them the perfect power couple, and they didn't mean this kindly. While George is no walk in the park, it's his wife that rivets your attention. After all, the book is titled with her name. You know, there are ambitious women, and then there's Serena Pemberton. She doesn't just walk into a room, she owns it the moment she enters. Her height already makes her formidable, but she comes from a family of loggers and is an expert on any subject she puts her mind to. While I'm always dreaming to be a stronger, more take-charge kind of gal, I do not want to even remotely emulate this character. Her strength and drive are deadly. Anything that threatens or even holds the potential of threat to her livelihood is dealt with efficiency and viciousness. And what of Rachel and the child she bears? Well, I guess they would be on that list as well, wouldn't they? Enjoy the book.
Thanks for listening to Book Talk. Catch our live radio show every Monday at noon Pacific on Seattle's KKNW AM 1150 or FM 98.9 HD. See conversationslive.net for program information and dozens of free podcasts. Check it out, conversationslive.net.
Hi, I'm Terry with tsigns.com with a quick tip for you. Next time you're crawling through traffic, think of it as promoting your business on the road. Reach potential new clients with custom-designed vehicle graphics, from a classy removable door sign to a full car body wrap, or a simple but effective window decal. We can do it all. We're a family-run business here to help new customers find you. See tsigns.com for a personal guarantee or call Terry today at 206-971-6800. Again, 206-971-6800.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
Alternative to what? Alternative to everything else out there on the radio, Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
You're my funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine. You make me smile.
Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And thank you, Eric Ryder, for that introduction, because my next guest is Adriana Trigiani. Her book out right now is called Very Valentine. And the second in the trilogy is about to be released this month. It's called Brava Valentine. Adriana is the New York Times bestselling author of the Big Stone Gap series, soon to be a big screen movie. She also wrote the novels Lucia Lucia, The Queen of the Big Time, and Rococo. I hope I said that right. She honed her skills writing for TV and is about, as I said, to release her second book in a trilogy, which is described as Sex and the City meets Moonstruck. Adriana, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me, Vicki. You know I love Seattle.
You're over there on the other coast, right? You're in New York.
I sure am freezing our buns off here.
Well, we've had the warmest January in history.
So jealous.
We cannot complain about that.
I'm so jealous. Good for you. I'm glad somebody's having a good winter. This is like we call them oh dear God winters, because you turn the corner and you can't believe what hits you in the face.
Oh, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. I can't imagine.
But I was looking at your background, Adriana. What a prolific writer you are. Let's go back a little and look at when you started writing and why you started writing. Mm-hmm. I know that you come from a long line of artists who all owned their own businesses. So you always had a very strong work ethic and knew that you'd express yourself as an artist somehow. And I guess you went to New York to become a playwright in the beginning.
I did. I was a theater major in college, and then and really, really found the thing that I loved, which was writing plays and working in the theater and creating those families as we do around plays. So when I moved to New York, I started a comedy group. And they were great girls, all sort of had different skills in the theater. Some were musicians and singers, and others had more acting ability. And So we worked on the club circuit for 7 years, and this was in the 1980s. And then I was so broke, to be really honest, Vicki, that my friends were worried about me. And at that time, you know, we always say you graduate with your class when you're an artist. So you basically, what you do is you try to find like-minded people, and, of course, the business-minded friends were working in mail rooms at big agencies, and they knew what was kind of coming in and going, and they knew that the ropes on all of that. And really, I didn't, because I didn't watch TV growing up, and that's odd for somebody of my generation, because most of my friends are TV junkies, but I really wasn't, because I grew up in Big Stone Gap in the 1970s, and the reception was terrible, and I didn't want to watch Fuzz on the channel, so I didn't watch much TV. So I was a reader, and I would not say that I was a brilliant student or any of that. I just loved to read, and then that really gave way to me writing, and I just stayed focused on that no matter what. If it was a comedy group, I wrote a lot of material, even though I performed it. And then with the sitcoms, I started to write situation comedies, and I was lucky to get on the biggest show at the time, which was The Cosby Show. And I did 2 years there at the end of the run. So that sort of poised me to be able to work in television, and I wrote a lot of pilots and worked on a lot of TV shows. And then I saw the ground shifting, and there weren't stories that I was really excited about writing.
Mm-hmm.
And any pilots I was trying to sell, it was hard to set them up. So it sounds sort of enchanted, and boy, do I love to hear you do the bio. It sounds so perfect, like it was all effortless. But it's been a hard slog, and you know, it is every single day that I sit here in this laundry room. It's a hard slog.
Right.
But here's the beauty of writing, and I learned this by being raised around people who survive by the labor of their own hands, which, by the way, is kind of a mission of mine. Every book of mine is about people who make things with their hands, and that's accidental in a way, but probably intentional because it's what I know. That if you figure out a way to serve people with something that you can make, you'll be assured that you can make a living. Now, I'm not going to say that everybody's going to make a pot of gold, but you will be able to feed your family, educate, clothe them, and survive because you have the skill to provide work. So that's a thing with me. I'm very interested in handmade goods and also manufacturing in the United States. That's another thing I'm very interested in.
Right.
But sadly, most of that has gone overseas, and I don't know if we'll ever get those jobs back, but I kind of keep harping on it, hoping that not only while you're being entertained reading these novels, that you pause and think about really what made this country so great.
Yeah. And you mentioned you grew up in Big Stone Gap. How did that influence you? I'm assuming that's where a lot of your work ethic stemmed from in the beginning.
Well, growing up in Big Stone Gap was really, for me, I mean, and I say this because I moved there when I was 6 years old, turning seven. And
it's in Virginia, right?
And it's in Virginia, and this was the late 1960s, so all of the big stuff had sort of happened culturally in terms of integration. You know, my teachers, many were African-American. There were African-Americans in our school. We sort of mixed and matched, you know what I mean?
It's like right.
It wasn't,
right.
There wasn't some glaring, you know, I didn't come up in a time where there was separation in my town, I will say. And then just the fact that we were Italian, we were exotic, foreign, and different, and mountain folk don't take to that. They don't like people from the outside coming in. So that was another layer. So I would call myself for sure kind of a loner fish out of water, even though I was highly social and loved my friends and had a ball there. There was always a feeling of separation and otherness.
Right, right.
That I think also sort of haunts my work because, you know, I always think that the person who doesn't fit in is the one who's got the most to say about what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have that ability to sort of separate from things. So,
right, take more objective.
Well, being raised in a coal mining town is a really interesting thing. I mean, I very much, you know, learned to look at the workforce in a different way and that you could actually go into that mine and not come out. I always thought about that a lot. And there were stories of my grandfather who inspired the shoemaking series, this very Valentine series about high-quality shoes. He also worked in an iron ore mine at night in Chisholm, Minnesota.
So I have mining in my background. Now, coal mining is different, of course, but mining is mining. They go in the ground and they're hacking away at rock, and it's very dangerous. So that was also a sensibility that sort of was developed in me growing up there.
Now, let's talk a little bit about this new series. This mm-hmm. is the second in the book, in the trilogy, is coming out mm-hmm. this month, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, it comes out February 9th. In fact, they start touring again with that.
And it's called Brava Valentine.
Brava Valentine. It's the second in the series, and it basically in Very Valentine. And I'm thrilled with this trade paperback because you get the first chapter of the second book, and you get a section that I labored over called Eat and Read. She falls in love with a chef, and I had to invent some recipes. And then I went to the mighty Vecchiarelli family in Youngstown, Ohio, who inspired the name Vecchiarelli in the novel. And they gave me recipes, too. So it's a little bit of a, you learn how to make, if you want to know how to make limoncello, I teach you. If you want to know how to make bizelles, I teach you. It's a great section. But Barry Valentine really sets the table for the series. And in it, Valentine Roncalli, that's where the name comes from. I have a cousin, Valentine Romano. I stole her name for this. I always loved that name, Valentine.
Yeah.
And she was a school teacher, and she was set to get married to a really nice guy who she's still friends with. But he married someone else and had a couple of kids. They ended the engagement. It was pretty amicable. And now she's 33, and her grandmother is 80 years old, and her grandmother is still working. In my family, there are two things that you need to know. We never retire, and we absolutely never look bad before we die. We look completely normal.
And I love it.
My father, before he died, I looked, turned to my mother, and said, he looks completely great, like he's taking a nap. But, of course, he wasn't. He was going to meet the Lord. So, anyway, the whole notion in the Valentine series of the table being set was that I wanted to really write about a woman from 33 to 43, because I think that's either where you really, you sort of make some big decisions. Are you going to marry somebody that already has kids? Are you going to get out of something you're in? Are you going to have a baby? These, for a woman, they're really
major decisions. Yeah,
it's a key, and then listen, no matter what they do with the cougar town and up the ages stuff, I want to say to these people, we're still all going to die, so don't act like it's such a big deal that you think you're milking an extra 5 years out of this deal, because it's not such a big deal. So I wanted to really get in there and write about that. So Valentine, I also love the idea that she found the thing that she loved to do. She didn't always know she loved it. She just found herself on weekends going to help the grandmother, and this magical shop, this place, any workrooms were always magical to me. My grandmother Lucia in Chisholm, Minnesota, as the seamstress, that was magical to me. And the blouse factory that my grandmother and grandfather had in Martins Creek, Pennsylvania, that was magical to me. Mm-hmm. And indeed, my father's factory. Factories are phenomenal because all these groups of people come in to work in there, and each machine sort of has a personality dictated by the operator. So I find them beehives that are really fun to write about.
Right. Well, I'm going to interrupt you just a second because we need to take just a very quick break. And we'll be right back with Adriana Trigiani. Her book is called Very Valentine. The second one coming out this month is Brava Valentine. And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Always one foot on the ground. Truly, I got lost in the sounds I hear in my mind.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
If you missed a show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Conversationslive.net, making a difference one word at a time.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
Proud to bring variety to your radio dial. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Suppose I kept on singing love songs just to break my own fall. Just to break my fall. Just to break my fall.
And welcome back. We've been spending this hour with two novelists, and my guest in this segment is Adriana Trigiani. She's written 11 books all told. One of them is actually a cooking book, I believe, a cookery book that she wrote with her sister. But we're talking primarily right now about the new series that is out. Very Valentine came out last year, and Brava Valentine is due to come out this month, and it's described as an intergenerational comedy. And you were telling us a little bit about your background, Adriana, before we went to break. And mm-hmm. I said during the break, what a fodder of information you had there to build these characters and build these stories.
It's very true. I mean, you know, when you call it an intergenerational comedy, you have to, because even the sad stuff is hilarious in a certain way. It's like our families, you know, we all look at each other and whisper, "She's nuts." And then, of course, they whisper, "We're nuts." So it's, you know, it's there is a lot of fodder. And the fodder comes from these interpersonal relationships and where we think we fit in our families. And I purposely sort of chose this middle child who seems to have blown it. You know, she broke up with her childhood boyfriend that she met in Queens, and he's gone on to have a big, illustrious career on Wall Street, and she's slogging. She's an apprentice to her grandmother in the shoe business, and they're making custom wedding shoes, which is a business. When it's up, it's up. When it's down, it's way down. There's this whole economic crisis happening in Manhattan that and across the country that is having people take pause to really look at how they spend money, and here you're making this custom item, which is a luxury item. So she really is up against, I think, the big questions that every single one of us is up against at this point, which is, how do I make a living doing what I love? And then, of course, the other big, big question is, who do I love? Who do I choose?
Right.
And who chooses me?
Right. There's everything in it. There's New York. There's Italy. Mm-hmm. Shoes, because she's a shoemaker. Mm-hmm. All my favorite things. Food,
well, let me tell you,
romance.
Vicki, I went to Italy. Oh, yeah, the food is unbelievable, right? People always say to me, "Boy, you really describe food." I said, because I'm hungry when I'm writing. I'm always on a diet, and I'm starving, and I'm trying to describe to you what something tastes like. And, you know, that's the free calorie. If you read it, you don't gain weight, you know? But going to Italy, I went over and studied with shoemakers because my grandfather, who was a shoemaker, died when he was 39 years old. So I didn't obviously get to talk to him. My mother and her twin sister were really helpful. And then, of course, I had a lot of stories that my grandmother Lucia had told me about him. And then when I went to Italy, I know it sounds crazy, but I met a particular shoemaker, and I thought, I bet Costanzo is like my grandfather Carlo. And we had an affinity for each other. And in the book, when she goes to the Isle of Capri, now we say here, when we do the Isle, we say the Isle of Capri, but in Italy
right.
they say Capri.
And
they
hit me with a rock 20 places.
Times. Oh, let me tell you, my hope and dream for everyone listening is that you get there.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Because you just won't believe it.
Yeah.
You won't believe it. It's enchanted. It really is. I think at one point Valentine says in the book, as they're approaching in the boat, she says, "The Isle of Capri looks like a party hat."
It does.
Stuck into the Mediterranean Sea. And it does. It looks like a party hat stuck in the ocean. And the bluest blue water and the most gorgeous sunsets. And I think at another point she describes the scent of the island, that it's a blood orange scooped out and filled with honey.
Mm.
So it really, that's really what it's it's dripping in delicious luxury, that island. And yet it's a, and the people that work it are very simple shoemakers or jewelers or whatever you have, leather works. Anyway, I actually met Costanzo Rocco, and Costanzo Rocco runs this little shop called Da Costanzo. And he's probably now in his early 70s, but he actually made shoes for Clark Gable, Sophia Loren,
wow.
Grace Kelly,
wow.
anybody that came to that island, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, he made sandals or shoes for. So I had had this whole tour set up to meet all these different shoemakers, and I just noticed he had a wedding ring on the chain around his neck, and I chronicle it in the book. That scene is all true. That's basically our conversation.
Oh, interesting. And you fell totally in love with him, even though you were
crazy about
really
him.
Young.
Well, you know, you can't help it with Italian men. They're just, they're so delicious. And I want to say this, as far as your beautiful radio signal will carry, go ahead, ladies, fall in love with the Italian men, but please don't marry them. And that's just my personal tip as an Italian. And I'm allowed to say it because I am Italian.
Well, I remember going there when I was much younger. I think I was about 26, and my mother was emigrating. So she took me and my sister, and we're both, like, my sister's 6 foot and blonde, and I was 5'10 and blonde, and we got followed everywhere.
Well,
I wouldn't today.
You're a couple of knockouts. That's like you were such exotics on that island, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I
have so it's a wonderful memories. Thing when you know, and really, Vicky, just when you're feeling bad, just jump on a plane and go to Italy, and you're instantly popular.
It's certainly a place where a lot of people go when they're having this midlife angst and they want to figure themselves out. A lot of people have ended up there, right?
It's
good food,
place
good wine.
Where are you going to go when you're having a crisis? You got to go somewhere pretty to lift your spirits. You can't go someplace that's going to depress you. Go to Italy. It's not going to hurt.
So is the main character anything like you at all?
Well, you know, it's tricky, Vicky, because I write in the first person because my favorite novel is Jane Eyre. And I love novels written in the first person. It's very comfortable to me. It's very real and authentic to me. So it sounds like me, I would say sometimes, but I actually picture the protagonist, and she isn't me. But here's what's funny. When I go places, I think I'm going to run into her. That's how crazy I am, okay? I actually think these people are real, and they're going to come around a corner and say, oh, hi, thanks for writing that. Chapter 7 was really good, or whatever they're going to say to me. But I think I emerge in different characters. My sensibility comes out in you know, certainly always in the gay male characters. I'm very present there. And I would say a little bit of me and kind of throughout, maybe mm-hmm. in the descriptions of things, but I really see them as real. So I guess the answer to that brilliant question is no. I guess not.
Well, I think writers can either separate themselves or else you see them all over the pages when they're creating characters. So that begs a good question. You know, where do you get your ideas for character development from? Because your book is character driven. I mean, New York is a character almost. Italy is a character almost.
Mm-hmm.
The shoes are characters.
I was only given one piece of advice, and I hope this helps, because that is a brilliant question. I don't get asked that a lot. About how do you do that part
mm-hmm.
of it? And there's two things. A writer hears voices all the time, not in a crazy way, or maybe it is crazy, but you hear the voices. I have conversations with myself all the time, and I have since I was small. And when I say with myself, it's whatever those voices are. The characters emerge really for me from people I don't want to forget. So when I write, a lot of times it's to remember details. There's a lot of details in this book, so I don't forget what my grandmother told me about my grandfather. So I hear them. That's the best way I can say it. I almost am, everything that I do is a tribute to them. I would say the word would be driven and obsessed about remembering.
Mm. Well, I think your grandfather would be totally honored and very proud of you, Adriana. We're almost at the end of our segment. I just wanted to let our listeners know that the Washington Post, the New York Times, People magazine have described Andrea's novels as tiramisu for the soul, sophisticated and wise, dazzling, and they all agree that her characters are so lively they bounce off the page. It's quite a compliment, Adriana.
Thank you so much, Vicky.
Thank you very much for being with us today. Would you give out your website so listeners can find out more about you?
It's so easy. Just Google AdrianaTrigiani.com, AdrianaTrigiani, and boom, I'm right there. You can go to Facebook. We have the whole thing. We're in cyberspace everywhere, floating around.
So. You are. And I know that Adriana's book is on Oprah's top 10 list right now. So
thank you, Oprah.
Check
thank
it out.
Thank you.
We'll be back next week with all new programming. Thank you so much for being with us today on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. You can find me through our website, conversationslive.net. See you next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Choice.
Coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, Dr. Kathleen Sherman says that while we know intellectually we have choice, few of us master the art of choice. If you're carrying any hurt from your past or finding it hard to break out of a rut, Dr. Sherman shares the path to emotional freedom. Join us next Monday at noon Pacific on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And see conversationslive.net for hundreds of past interviews and book review podcasts.
Where you talk about choice as if it's something we were born with.